Hey everyone, and welcome to the Deep Dive. We're diving into a topic that's, well, it's not exactly light dinner conversation,
Definitely not, no.
but it's super important and frankly, pretty fascinating. We're talking disaster economics today.
Yes, the economics of the the not so good times.
Exactly. How do we prepare for and respond to those large-scale events? You know, the kind that can really turn things upside down. And how does economics fit into all of that?
Well, it's all about I guess you could say making the most of what we've got, because when disaster strikes, resources are always going to be limited.
Right. It's about being smart with every dollar, every decision.
Exactly. That's what disaster economics is all about.
And we're going to get into all that today using insights from an international disaster management lecture. Trust me, this stuff is eye-opening.
Oh, for sure. We'll be looking at some really tough questions like how do we balance those immediate needs with the long-term goals? And how do we even measure if what we're doing is actually working?
Yeah, because in a disaster, every choice we make, every single one.
As a ripple effect. So how do we make sure those ripples are doing some good, creating positive change?
Right. Well, one of the most important things to think about is what we call value for money.
Okay, now I've heard that phrase before, but I gotta be honest, it always sounds a little dot cold, like, are we really talking about money when people are suffering?
I get that. It definitely sounds a bit, well, a bit harsh when you put it that way. But it's not about being cheap. It's about getting the most impact, the most bang for your buck, so to speak, for every dollar spent.
Okay, so it's about being strategic.
Exactly. And there's a framework that helps us with this, the four E's of value for money:
Four E's, huh?
economy, efficiency, effectiveness, and equity.
All right, break those down for me. How do those four concepts actually, play out in a real disaster situation?
Sure. Let's say there's a major earthquake,
Yes.
right? And we need to get emergency supplies to the people who need them.
Food, water, shelter.
Exactly. All that. So, economy is all about getting those supplies as cheaply as possible, making sure we're getting the best deals on tents, food, medical equipment, that kind of thing.
Makes sense. Stretch those dollars as far as they'll go.
Right. But then you have efficiency. That's about how those supplies actually get to the people who need them.
So logistics.
Logistics. You got to make sure it's all happening quickly, efficiently, and with, as little waste as possible. No one wants to see supplies stuck in a warehouse when people are in desperate need.
I've definitely seen those stories. It's heartbreaking.
Exactly. But it's not enough to just get those supplies there, right? We also need to make sure they're actually making a difference. That's where effectiveness comes in.
Okay, so are we actually reducing suffering? Are we saving lives?
That's it.
Yeah.
Are those supplies actually meeting the real needs on the ground? Because sometimes, there's a disconnect.
Yeah, I can see that.
Like maybe we send a bunch of blankets, but what people really need are, I don't know, water purification tablets or something.
Right. Makes sense.
And then finally, there's equity. And this is a big one. Are we reaching everyone who's affected, especially those who are the most vulnerable?
So not just the easiest to reach, but the ones who need the most help.
Exactly. Are resources being distributed fairly? Are we leaving anyone behind?
It's about making sure those who need help the most aren't forgotten.
Exactly. And these four S, economy, efficiency, effectiveness, and equity, they're kind of woven throughout everything we do in disaster management, from the very beginning all the way to the end.
Now, I know we always see the immediate costs of a disaster on the news, the destroyed buildings, the flooded streets, the dollar amount of the damage. But the real economic impact runs much deeper than that, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. We got to think about both the direct and indirect costs.
Okay, so the direct costs are those immediate, obvious things, right?
The damage we can all see. Damage to homes, businesses, infrastructure, plus the cost of the emergency response itself.
And the indirect costs,
Those
the
then.
ripple effects. The hidden costs that stick around for years, even decades sometimes. So, give me an example. What are some of those indirect costs that people might not immediately think about?
Okay, picture this. A huge hurricane slams into a coastal region. Factories are damaged, businesses have to shut down, supply chains get totally disrupted.
Okay, I'm seeing it.
Now, suddenly, people who are miles away from the actual hurricane are feeling the effects. They might lose their jobs, prices for basic goods might go up, and then that has this cascading effect on the whole economy.
Like a domino effect.
Exactly. One thing leads to another, and then another.
And then there are the social costs too, right?
Oh, absolutely. Those are even tougher to measure, but man, they're just as devastating.
Like, what kind of things are we talking about?
Well, think about it. Disasters can lead to mental health issues, displacement, kids being out of school for who knows how long.
Yeah, that's rough.
These things can have long-term consequences for individuals, for families, for entire communities, really.
So we're talking about not just rebuilding buildings, but rebuilding lives.
That's exactly it. And, you know, this leads us to a topic that's always a bit controversial when we're talking disaster economics. It's this idea of, well, of putting a value on human life.
Ooh, yeah, that's tricky territory for sure. How do you even begin to measure something like that?
It's complicated. And honestly, it's something that people have a lot of different opinions about. But one way that it's sometimes done is using something called the value of statistical life.
VSL, I've heard that one before.
Yep. Now, before you say anything, I know this concept can be kind of unsettling for some folks, but I think it's important to understand how it's used.
I got a listing. Go ahead.
So essentially, VSL tries to estimate the economic value of, well, of saving a life. And they do this by looking at how much people are willing to pay to, you know, reduce their risk of dying.
So like if someone's willing to pay extra for a safer car, for example.
That's the idea. You can use that kind of information to get a sense of how much they value their own safety and by extension, their own life.
I guess that makes sense on some level, but.
But it's definitely not perfect. And there are a lot of complexities and limitations to this approach.
Yeah, like you can't really put a price tag on emotional value.
Right.
Or cultural differences in how we view life and death.
You got it. And then there's the whole issue of whether people's willingness to pay is even, you know, a reliable measure. Like, what if someone simply can't afford to pay more for that safer car, even if they want to?
It starts to feel very cold and calculating. Like, we're reducing something incredibly complex and profound down to just dollars and cents.
It can feel that way, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's why there are other ways to try to look at this, you know, more holistically. Things like quality-adjusted life years, or QALYs.
Oh, I've heard of those.
They consider not just the number of years that are saved, but also, you know, the quality of those years.
So, like, if someone is living with a lot of pain or disability, it's not the same as saving a life that's full of health and vitality.
Exactly. And I think that brings us to another really important point. Economic models and numbers can be useful tools, but they can only tell us so much. We got to remember the human element, the social and emotional impacts, the ethical stuff. All of that's got to be part of the equation, too.
Because at the end of the day, behind all those numbers, behind those cost-benefit analyses, are real people, right? Real families, real communities whose lives are being forever changed by these events.
Absolutely. We can't forget that human side of things. It's what makes this whole field so, well, so challenging.
For sure. Now, I got to ask about something we touched on earlier. You said that disasters can sometimes actually boost economic growth. That seems kind of counterintuitive.
It does, doesn't it? Like, how can something so destructive actually be good for the economy?
Exactly.
Well, there's this idea called creative destructionism, and it basically says that even though disasters are awful, they can also clear the way for progress and, yeah, even economic growth.
So are we talking about the whole you got to break a few eggs to make an omelet kind of thing?
Kind of, yeah. Think about it like this. A major earthquake levels a city, right? Obviously, it's tragedy. People lose their homes, their businesses. But at the same time, it creates this opportunity to rebuild. And not just rebuild, but to build back better than before.
So you're saying, like, we can use newer technologies, stronger materials, and we can learn from what went wrong the first time around.
Exactly. We can make these more resilient, more efficient. Plus, when a disaster hits, there's often a huge influx of aid and investment pouring into the affected area.
Right. Everyone wants to help.
Exactly. And that rebuilding process, it creates jobs, it stimulates the local economy, and yeah, in some cases, it can even lead to long-term economic growth.
I can see that, but I'm guessing there are some downsides to this whole creative destruction idea, right?
Oh, absolutely. We can't forget that this kind of progress, it comes at a huge human cost. I mean, people's lives are upended. So we definitely don't want to romanticize disasters or anything like that.
Right, because those broken eggs we were talking about, they represent real people, real families who are suffering.
Exactly. And that's where another economic concept comes in. It's called the broken window fallacy.
Okay, I'm intrigued. What's that all about?
Well, it's this idea that rebuilding after a disaster, it might look like economic growth because, you know, there's all this activity, all this spending going on.
Right. People are working. Money is changing hands.
Yeah, but it's kind of misleading Because that money, those resources that are being used to rebuild, they could have been spent on other things. Things that might have actually led to real new economic growth.
So it's not really new growth, it's just shifting things around.
Exactly. It's like, imagine that money that's being spent rebuilding a school that got destroyed in a flood. What if that money had been used to build a brand new hospital or invest in renewable energy? That's what we call opportunity cost.
What we're missing out on by focusing on the immediate crisis.
Right. It's not just about the immediate impact. It's about those long-term consequences and thinking carefully about how we use those scarce resources.
Makes sense. Which brings us back to that whole value for money concept, or VFM. I know that's a big part of the lecture notes we're looking at today.
It's super important. It's really at the heart of good disaster management. And like I said before, it's not about being cheap. It's about getting the most impact, the most bang for our buck, from every dollar we spend on disaster risk reduction and humanitarian response.
And we already talked about the four E's of value for money, but how do those concepts actually play out in the real world? Can you give me some examples?
Sure. Let's say we're thinking about investing in some early warning systems in a region that gets hit by cyclones a lot.
Okay, good example.
So economy in this case would be finding the most affordable technology and figuring out the cheapest way to install these systems. Efficiency means making sure they're reliable, easy for people to use, and can send out those warnings quickly to everyone.
So people have time to get to safety.
All right. Then effectiveness is about making sure people actually pay attention to those warnings and do what they need to do to protect themselves. Because what's the point of a warning system if nobody listens, right?
Right. A warning that's ignored doesn't save anyone.
Exactly. And then finally, we've got equity. That means making sure those warnings reach everyone, especially those communities that are often marginalized, the ones who might not have access to the internet or who speak different languages.
It's about making sure everyone has a chance to be safe.
That's it. And you can see how all those four E's really work together.
Yeah, it's a much more holistic approach. Now, another tool you mentioned was cost-benefit analysis. Can you refresh my memory on that?
Sure. Basically, it's just what it sounds like. You look at the costs of doing something, and then you compare that to the benefits. So let's say we're thinking about building a seawall to protect a coastal community from flooding.
Okay, I can see where this is going.
We would look at how much it would cost to build and maintain that seawall, and then we'd compare that to the benefits. You know, how much damage would it prevent? How many lives could be saved?
So you're basically trying to figure out if it's worth the investment in the long run.
Exactly. But this is where things get tricky, because how do you really put a price tag on a human life? Or on the disruption to an entire community.
Right. Those are real costs, but they're hard to measure in purely economic terms.
For sure. So cost-benefit analysis can be helpful, but it's definitely not the only thing we should be considering when it comes to disaster management. There's always that human element, those ethical considerations, the stuff that you just can't capture in the spreadsheet.
It's about using the tool wisely,
right?
Understanding its limitations.
Absolutely. And we always have to remember that these cost-benefit analyses, they're based on, well, on assumptions and projections. We're dealing with complex systems here, and there's always a certain amount of, well, risk and uncertainty. We can't predict the future perfectly.
We're making the best decisions we can with the information we have.
Exactly. And that brings us to another important distinction, the difference between cost efficiency and cost effectiveness.
Oh, I always get those two mixed up.
I know, it can be confusing. But think of it this way. Cost efficiency is all about doing something as cheaply as possible. So let's say we're giving out emergency food rations after a disaster. Cost efficiency would mean getting those rations to people at the lowest possible cost per unit.
So it's about making sure you're not wasting any money.
Right. But cost effectiveness is about the bigger picture. It's about, okay, is that food actually nutritious? Is it culturally appropriate? Are those rations actually meeting people's needs?
So it's not just about how much it costs, but whether it's actually the right thing to do.
You got it. And sometimes, you know, the cheapest option might not be the most effective in the long run.
Interesting. It's about looking at the whole picture.
Exactly. And speaking of looking at the big picture, that brings us to a couple of other concepts that are really important in disaster economics, sunk costs and opportunity costs.
Okay. I think I've heard of those, but remind me what they're all about.
Sunk costs are those investments we've already made, money that's already been spent and can't be recovered. Like if we've already spent millions of dollars on building a levee to prevent flooding, that money's gone, whether the levee works or not.
So it's like, don't cry over spilled milk. What's done is done.
Exactly. But here's the thing. Sometimes we let those sunk costs kind of cloud our judgment. We might keep pouring money into that levy, even if it's not really working, just because we feel like we've already invested so much.
I see. We're trying to justify those past decisions.
Right. And that's where opportunity costs come in. It's all about what we're giving up when we make a choice. So in that levy example, if we keep spending all this money trying to fix it, we might not have enough to invest in other solutions, like relocating people away from the flood zone.
Or investing in early warning systems, like you were saying before.
Exactly. It's about realizing that every decision we make, it means we're saying no to something else.
There are always trade-offs.
Always. And understanding opportunity costs helps us make smarter choices.
Mm.
You know, it helps us avoid getting stuck in those cycles of doing things the way we've always done them, even if it's not working anymore.
It's about being brave enough to admit when we made a mistake and being willing to change course.
I like that. Brave enough to change course.
I'm sensing a theme here. It seems like a lot of disaster economics is about, well, challenging the way we normally think about things.
You're totally right. There's no one-size-fits-all solution when it comes to disasters. Every situation is different. Every community has its own unique needs. And every disaster, well, it brings its own set of challenges.
So we got to be adaptable, willing to change our approach depending on the situation.
For sure. And this leads to another point that often comes up in disaster economics. We tend to get really focused on those short-term solutions, on putting out the immediate fire, so to speak.
Right. We see that all the time, don't we? It's much easier to raise money for immediate disaster relief than it is for those long-term projects that might actually prevent disasters from happening in the first place.
It's true, and it's a problem. Because when we only focus on those short-term needs, we often miss the chance to fix the underlying problems, you know, the things that make communities so vulnerable to disasters in the first place.
It's like putting a Band-Aid on a broken leg.
That's a great way to put it. We need to shift our focus from reacting to disasters to preventing them, from putting out fires to building fireproof homes, you know.
Right. So it's about investing in those long-term solutions that might not have immediate flashy results, but that will make a real difference down the line.
Exactly. But that takes a lot of, well, a lot of political will, a real commitment to sustainability. And it means being willing to challenge the way we usually do things.
We have to break out of those short-term thinking cycles. It's not easy.
It's not, but it's necessary. Now, I know we've been talking a lot about challenging assumptions and thinking long-term, and all of this is really making me think back to those lecture notes. What else did they highlight as, you know, key things to understand about this field? Give me some more takeaways. Well, one of the main things they emphasize is that disaster economics, it's not just about saving money. It's about saving lives.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, that seems obvious, but I'm guessing there's more to it than that.
There is. It's about really understanding that every human life is precious,
mm-hmm.
It has value, and our decisions, especially when it comes to economics, should reflect that.
It's about bringing compassion into the equation.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about recognizing that those who are already the most vulnerable, they're often the ones who are hit hardest by disasters.
So we have to make sure they're not forgotten or left behind?
Right. We have a responsibility to prioritize their needs. It's about fairness and social justice.
It's about making sure that everyone has a chance to not just survive, but to thrive, even after a disaster.
Well said. And that brings us to another really important point from those lecture notes, transparency and accountability. They're crucial in everything we do when it comes to disaster management.
I'm seeing a pattern here. It seems like we need to be willing to, well, hold ourselves to a higher standard, to be open about what we're doing and why.
That's it. Transparency means making sure that everyone has access to information about, you know, how money is being spent, how programs are being run,
mm-hmm.
and what the results are. We have to be open and honest, even when things don't go as planned.
So it's about building trust. People need to know that their donations, their time, their efforts are being used effectively and ethically.
Exactly. And then there's accountability. That means taking responsibility for the choices we make and, you know, being willing to admit when we make mistakes. We need to have systems in place so we can see what's working and what's not, and so we can learn from our experiences.
It's about constantly trying to improve, to do better next time.
That's it. And this requires collaboration, innovation, and, yeah, a willingness to really challenge the way things have always been done.
Mm.
Because sometimes those old ways of thinking, they can actually perpetuate systems that are, well, ineffective or even unfair.
It's about working together, learning from each other, and always striving to do better.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
So we've covered a ton about disaster economics, the human costs, those long-term impacts. We even talked about how sometimes we need to challenge the way we think about all this. But, for our listeners out there who are maybe feeling a little overwhelmed or even helpless, what can they actually do with this information? How can they make a difference?
That's a great question. And, it's encouraging that people want to put this knowledge into action. The lecture we've been talking about, it actually offers some concrete steps people can take to be, well, more active and informed citizens when it comes to disasters.
I like it. Okay, so what's step one? Lay it on me.
Well, it all starts with education. I mean, the more we understand about how, the economics of disasters actually works and how important it is to be proactive and reduce those risks, well, the better equipped we are to actually advocate for change.
So it's kind of like the old saying, knowledge is power.
Yeah, exactly. Once we have that knowledge, we can use it to spread the word, raise awareness in our communities, talk to our families and friends, and even push for policies that, well, that put disaster preparedness and long-term resilience front and center.
Okay, so get educated and then get loud. But how? How do we actually advocate for change, like specifically?
Well, there are a lot of ways to do that. I mean, you can contact your elected officials and tell them you want them to support legislation that, promotes disaster risk reduction.
Yeah.
You can get involved with organizations that are already out there doing the work, whether it's local or global.
Right, put your money where your mouth is.
Exactly. Or even volunteer your time. Every little bit helps.
So it's about using our voices, our resources, and our time to make a difference.
And, when you start doing those things, even small things, it can inspire others to do the same. It creates this ripple effect.
It shows people that they're not alone and that we can make a difference, even if it feels small.
I love that. And speaking of taking action, the lecture really emphasized the importance of personal preparedness, getting ourselves and our families ready for a potential disaster.
Yeah, because it's easy to get caught up in all the theory, but we can't forget that these disasters, they have real consequences.
Real-world consequences, yeah. And being prepared can, well, it can literally be the difference between life and death.
Okay, so what can our listeners do to prepare? Give us some practical tips.
First, think about your own risk. I mean, where do you live? What kind of disasters are most likely to happen there? Are you prepared for an earthquake, a flood, a hurricane?
Know your enemy, right?
Exactly. Once you know what you're dealing with, you can make a plan. Have a meeting place for your family in case you get separated. Stock up on essential supplies, things like food, water, a first aid kit.
Don't forget those important documents, passports, insurance policies. Keep them somewhere safe and easy to grab in a hurry.
Good point. And if you're in an earthquake-prone area, make sure you know how to turn off your gas and water lines, just in case.
Right, those little things can make a big difference.
Absolutely. And this doesn't have to be overwhelming or expensive. There are tons of resources out there, online and in your community, to help you get started.
And don't be afraid to talk to your neighbors. You can help each other prepare.
Right. Community connections are so important, especially during a disaster.
We're all in this together. We need to look out for each other.
That's the spirit. I'm glad we talked about these practical steps, but I also think it's important to step back and think about, well, the bigger picture. Like, what kind of systemic changes need to happen to make the whole world more resilient and equitable,
Yeah, let's get big picture for a minute.
One thing that really stood out in the lecture was the importance of, I guess you could say, challenging the narrative, the idea that disasters are just natural events, acts of God, things we can't control.
Because that's just not true, right? Humans have a huge impact on the severity of these disasters.
That's right. I mean, deforestation, bad urban planning, climate change, all these things are making disasters more frequent and more intense. And when we pretend like humans have nothing to do with it, we're basically just avoiding responsibility.
So it's not just about preparing for disasters, it's about preventing them in the first place.
Exactly. We need to be pushing for policies that support sustainable development, that reduce our impact on the climate, and of course, that invest in disaster risk reduction.
It's about making those hard choices now to create a better future.
Exactly. And those choices might not always be easy or popular, but they're what we got to do if we want a world where, well, where everyone has a chance to thrive.
Okay, so before we wrap things up, I want to touch on one last point from the lecture, the need for research and innovation.
Oh, yeah, that's a big one. This field is constantly evolving, and there's still so much we don't know. We need more data, better models, more creative ways to solve these complex problems, especially with climate change and the fact that, well, the world's getting more and more interconnected every day.
It's about investing in the future.
Totally. And that investment can take a lot of different forms. You know, it could be funding research at universities, giving grants to community organizations, or even supporting those startups that are coming up with new technologies to help us prepare for and respond to disasters.
It's about recognizing that the best solutions can come from anywhere.
Couldn't agree more.
Well, I think that about wraps up our deep dive into disaster economics. I want to thank you for sharing your insights with us.
It's been great. Thanks for having me.
And to our listeners, we hope you found this discussion informative, maybe even inspiring. Remember, we're not helpless when it comes to these challenges. We've got the knowledge, we've got the tools, and I think we're starting to build the momentum to really make a difference. It's just a matter of, well, making it a priority.
And remember, it's not just about dollars and cents, it's about people. It's about recognizing the value of every human life and working together to create a world that's more just, equitable, and resilient for everyone.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.